Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why did soldiers on the front lines of one of the deadliest wars lay down their arms and play soccer with the very men they were supposed to shoot? We'll revisit the Christmas Truce of 1914. Then, religion, politics, and the so-called God Gap. We'll explore how religion both unites and divides us. Finally, in the midst of so much bad news, what in the world is getting better? We'll look at the widespread improvements in the world. World War I was one of the deadliest periods in human history, but it was also the time of one of the most profound, impromptu expressions of humanity. Tens of thousands of soldiers on the front lines laid down their arms, exchanged gifts, songs, and makeshift soccer balls in what became known as the Christmas Truce. How did the peace come about? And what do the historic events tell us about humanity? Stanley Weintraub joins us now. He's a professor emeritus at Pennsylvania State University, a historian and author. His more than 50 books include Silent Night, The Story of the World War I Christmas Truce, and his latest, Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. Welcome, Stanley Weintraub.
Glad to be with you.
It's great to have you with us. I thought perhaps we should start with a little bit of context of what was going on during World War I in 1914 before the Christmas Truce.
We have to think that Christmas was not on the minds of soldiers on either side in mid-December 1914. The weather was plain lousy. The weather was cold rain just above freezing. Where the Christmas Truce began was in Flanders, the area of Belgium, France, just below the North Sea and the English Channel, where the land was actually below sea level, held in by dikes and bulwarks and seawalls. They were living in miserable conditions because everything was muddy. The troops on both sides had dug in trenches. There was a stalemate that had taken place just after the bad weather began in late November. They were living in terrible shape. The trenches were flooded. Cold rain and mud had made things worse. Unless soldiers in mucky hideaways stayed awake, they could drown, quite literally sinking into the liquefying mud. Many slept erect where they could. It was very difficult to accomplish one's bodily functions or sleep or eat under those conditions. And so there was not much fighting. It was a matter of live and let live until the weather got better. And it was under those conditions that the Christmas Truce began. A German soldier who later became a famous artist named Otto Dix was on the front lines, and he described the landscape as lice, rats, barbed wire, fleas, bombs, underground caves, corpses, blood, liquor, mice, cats, artillery, filth, bullets, mortars, fire, steel. That's what war is, he said. It's the work of the devil. So under those conditions, it was a live and let live situation until something happened that made a Christmas truce Christmassy. And that began on both sides independently. The British during the Boer War, that is the war in South Africa in 1899-1900, had sent brass Christmas boxes to the troops thousands of miles away, figuring that they'd be lonely and unhappy that far away. And Queen Victoria, in her last years, arranged for this. These were small brass boxes filled basically with chocolates, and the troops loved getting them. Some of them claimed that having them in their pockets actually stopped bullets. But in any cases, in 1914, military people remembered doing this and decided, let's do it again. And so they prepared brass Christmas boxes to send across the North Sea to Belgium and Flanders for their troops, basically, again, containing chocolates, in some cases other kinds of goodies. The Germans got wind of this, and they prepared wooden boxes, pretty much the same size, pretty much like 3x5, and they put in them sausages and typically German goodies and cigars and cigarettes, and these were sent to the troops. But the Germans had something else they could do that the British couldn't. The Germans originated the idea of the Christmas tree, and their idea was the tabletop Christmas tree, not the big monsters that we have over here. The Christmas trees could be brought into the front lines quite literally by the Germans because they, after all, had a ground connection to Germany, which the British didn't. The British had to cross the water for it. And so the Germans brought in Christmas trees and had them already fixed with candles attached. Lighting candles would have been a serious mistake in the front lines, but the Germans decided they'd do so anyway. After all, there was this live and let peace, and they take a chance that the bullets might fly. And on the bulwarks of their trenches, many German soldiers propped up the Christmas trees that had been sent into them and lit the candles and waited to see what would happen. In some cases, there were some shots fired at them. In most cases, the British were intensely curious as to what was going on across the front lines only 60 or 70 yards away. You have to remember that the distances between the enemies was actually shorter than the length of a football field, but they were separated by trenches and by very bad weather and by bulwarks above the trenches. The British actually crawled out into no man's land, the area between the trenches, to see what was going on. And the Germans, seeing that, crawled out too. And pretty soon there was some camaraderie in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve. There began the actual Christmas truce.
I wanted to back up because, as I understood from your book, this actually did begin perhaps mid-December, a few weeks out.
There were a few cases about the 19th of December, in other words, about a week before Christmas, when this live and let live policy in that bad weather resulted in temporary cessations of shooting so both sides could retrieve their wounded and their dead and bury the dead. And they got to know each other that way, and they discovered that they were people like themselves. You can demonize the enemy from far away, but you can't demonize your enemy when the enemy is close up, especially when they look like you. And this is one of the reasons why we haven't had Christmas truces before or since. In most cases, the Christmas truce, which was unique in 1914, couldn't happen because of the cultural differences, the cultural distances, in fact. After all, I spent two Christmases in Korea during the Korean War myself as a young officer. The North Koreans and the Chinese weren't interested in Christmas. That wasn't their holiday. We could not have had a Christmas truce on the front lines. This couldn't have happened in World War II fighting the Japanese. It couldn't have happened with the Nazis who didn't believe in Christmas in World War II. So this was a very unusual situation when both sides loved Christmas trees and Christmas gifts and sang Christmas carols and looked like each other.
I thought there were many interesting occurrences in your book that describe what was going on. There was one particular time about a week before Christmas when the Germans ostensibly slipped a chocolate cake into the British lines with an invitation to a concert.
They said it was their captain's birthday, and they were going to have a concert for him, and the British could listen. They weren't Christmas carols, but this was something that had happened in an earlier war, the idea of a concert given by another side. During the Civil War, there were occasions when North and South had trumpet competitions across the lines. They had cornets and trumpets and bands. Now, they didn't really meet, but there was this musical competition. In World War I, at least in the first year of the war, the two sides on Christmas Eve sang to each other. The Germans began it singing Silent Night, and although they sang it in German, the tune was familiar to the British. They sang it too in their own language. Songs went back and forth between the sides during the darkness of Christmas Eve, and pretty soon there was competition again. The Germans had a singer from the Berlin Opera named Walter Kirchhoff, who was called on to sing, and he sang Christmas carols very lustily across the trenches. It sounds unbelievable, but when you realize there was less than the length of a football field between them, and they were bogged down in rain and mud, and unlikely to try to advance or fire, it's easy to see how this could happen. The French hated the Germans because in 1870, the Germans had warred on the French and taken the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine away from the French. Theoretically, they weren't going to have any Christmas truce, and censorship claimed that they didn't, but the French sent out a singer from the Paris Opera who sang to the Germans, O Holy Night, And so there was a very strange, almost dreamlike atmosphere that was beginning to permeate both lines.
So there actually says something about two things here. One is, as you mentioned, the demonization of somebody who's right in front of you, which is a little bit harder to do. It also speaks about this kind of shared cultural connection, but it's also the power of music.
The power of music certainly had a lot to do with it. The British were far more interested in singing bawdy songs to the Germans, which they did, and I quote several of them in my book. The Germans were amused by it and knew English. This was, again, one of the unusual factors. Many of the Germans had actually worked in England before the war. They had had jobs as barbers and taxi drivers and waiters and other kinds of jobs that didn't require a good deal of schooling, but they learned English. And their officers and some other senior people in their lines learned English in school. The British didn't learn German, but the Germans learned English, and they could speak to the British, and they could exchange jabs at them and sing at them. So there was a cultural mix that couldn't have occurred in any other wars. One thing they wanted to do, as they had done before, was bury the dead. They could get together more closely if they could cross their lines, which were pockmarked by shell holes filled with water and also blocked by corpses that had been there for quite a long time. They wanted to bury them. And somebody got the idea, which spread across the lines, we could play football in daylight if we had a clear area. And so they agreed that after dawn, they would get together between the lines, they'd fill in the shell holes, and they'd bury the dead. And they did in many areas in the 300-mile length of the front lines from the North Sea to the Swiss border. And that meant the Belgians and the British and the French and the Germans on the other side, who included Austrians and Bavarians, who were far more peaceful-minded than the Prussians on the German side. And they did bury the dead in joint ceremonies. Their chaplains came out and officiated. And they did actually play soccer, football in their language. At first, I didn't believe this happened. I had read little bits about the Christmas truce, and many historians said, well, this, of course, was legendary. And the whole idea that they could have played football is quite mythic. But I looked it up in the Imperial War Museum in London and in archives in Germany and in letters sent by the troops. And certainly they played football. They described it very accurately. They used improvised balls and goals. And their official documents, the company diaries kept, even had the scores.
And so, who won?
The Germans won most of the games. And they were very proud of that. But the important thing was that they were able to get together on Christmas Day and pretend that there was no war going on between them. At last, of course.
I want to get into why that was as we get through what actually happened. Here we have these soldiers on the front lines laying their weapons down and fraternizing with the other side, despite the fact that it's a court-martial offense.
But you see, they had gifts they could give out. They had their Christmas boxes, and they had other presents sent from home. The British were loaded up with presents because the newspapers had publicized the fact that the troops need gifts, and they were loaded up with mince pies and other such things. The Germans had never seen a mince pie, and the British were glad to get rid of a lot of them. There was a lot of trading back and forth, and in one case I found a German had traded his helmet, the Tickelhaube with the horn-like device at the top of the helmet, to a British soldier. And a day later, he came back to the soldier and said, we're going to have an inspection. I need to borrow it back. The British had no helmets yet. It would be 2 years into the war before they had steel helmets. And the Germans had those old-fashioned Tickelhaube helmets. They traded food. They traded various kinds of equipment. And they mixed together. And they did so until the German higher-ranking officers and the Allied higher-ranking officers began to be concerned. After all, there's no war if the soldiers don't fight. You've got to get them back to fighting again. And they actually managed to do so. It wasn't easy, because once you meet your friends who are the enemy and you see them face to face, it's hard to fight them again. One soldier actually met his barber, his former barber, who's German, and he said, "You need a back and sides, sit down and I'll take care of that." And he trimmed his hair on the front lines. What do you do under such circumstances? They sang together, they ate together. The only thing they could do from the higher up angle was to move them out. In other words, to replace them with reserves who had been indoctrinated to hate. And so they pulled out many of the troops on the front lines, and after Christmas replaced them with other troops and forced them to fire again.
Just a quick reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Stanley Weintraub about the historic impromptu ceasefire of World War I, known as the Christmas Truce. A couple of things I just wanted to go back and get. One is, you described this as everywhere you looked, people were talking and playing. How many of the front lines really were engaged?
It depended on the commanding officers involved. There were areas where there was no fighting, and there were areas where the senior officers said, "I order you under pain of court-martial to keep fighting." And so some of them had to shoot. When they did, they generally shot high up in the air over the heads of the troops opposite them, and they refused to have actual fighting go on. I found a number of instances of this where the junior officers on both sides would go out into no man's land and meet, and they would say, "We're being forced to fire again. We'll fire high up in the air. We'll send a flare up to let you know, and then you can go into hiding or into your trenches." And they did this in very surprising ways. Often they exchanged gifts. A German would exchange his gloves for a British scarf, for example. And then they'd go back and they'd fire a flare, and a few hours later the fighting would resume. In some cases it lasted into New Year's, not because they were celebrating New Year's Day, but because the weather was still so bad.
One of the instances that you described in your book was when a French person warned the Germans to, quote, "be on guard tomorrow. A general is coming to visit our position. For reasons of shame and honor, we will have to fire."
And of course they did. But there were some very strange things that occurred that are almost unbelievable. Soldiers would write home about them and talk about them as if they were a waking dream. And I researched this over the years by going to the British newspaper library in North London in Colindale and reading the letters to the editor in provincial newspapers where soldiers had written to their wives and girlfriends and parents. This is before censorship. And said, "You won't believe what has just happened," and went on to describe the meetings between the two sides and the fraternization. And the newspapers were sent these by the people who received those letters, and they printed them. So I found literally hundreds of such letters, both in Germany and in England, that were printed before censorship began. And they proved the extent of the fraternization.
You mentioned the media's response, and it sounded from what you found in your research that there was considerable resistance in mass media, other than these letters, to treat this as important as you see it as, like they really downplayed it. What is your assessment of this?
The managements of the newspapers were trying to be ultra-patriotic, and they didn't like this idea, but the pressure for such news was terrific. In one case, a German juggler who had performed in England came out and performed his juggling act between the trenches. There were all kinds of episodes like this that, as the soldiers said, seemed like a waking dream. But a dream doesn't last. You wake up, and you wake up to reality. And the war began again, and there would never be another Christmas truce in military history.
And do you think we never have another Christmas truce in military history, partly because the leaders who, you made very clear, this is war is being driven by the leaders, not by the soldiers, and that the soldiers, in fact, did want to fraternize and embrace the other. Is it because the leaders learned from this?
Well, the military leaders are a professional group. Their job is to win wars, to fight and win wars, to fight and defend one's country. And soldiers, for the most part, in a big war, are drafted. They come from the farms and the factories and other such places, and they're not professional. They have no careers dependent on winning a war, and they have to be propagandized into wanting to win a war. It's very difficult, for example, right now, to try to convince a soldier, even though he's an enlisted person in Afghanistan, that there's something very important for his own country involved in fighting and possibly dying in Afghanistan.
When you look at this in a historical context and you do put it in today's time frame, which, for example, in the Afghanistan case that you mentioned, what do you take away as the wisdom of the Christmas truce?
The wisdom of the Christmas truce is that we're all the same, and there are many reasons why we should be friends instead of enemies. And that's hard to accept if there are no cultural connections. It's hard to accept if you have the other side unwilling to admit that there is anything that you represent that is going to create friendship.
The other takeaway that I thought about is the role of leaders and the role of mass media in some cases in being able to convince people of the either reasons for the war and the demonization of the other and all of the beliefs that can arise from that. And one thing that I underlined in your book pertained to a particular leader, which was Hitler, who would not participate in the Christmas truce.
He didn't believe in Christmas, so he wouldn't participate. He hated the enemy, and the enemy didn't believe anything that he did. But you mentioned the mass media, and that's a big difference now, too. The mass media during World War I, 1914, were largely the newspapers, and the newspaper owners represented, in effect, big business and therefore big government. That has become dissipated. Radio came in, television came in, and when television came in, I was in Korea in 1951-52, when live television existed in America, and cameramen would have to fly their film to Tokyo and then to the United States in order to be put on television. But it brought home the reality of war, what it was really like visually. That hadn't happened before. Now we have other mass media, all the electronic media, and it's very difficult to try to manipulate all of the sources of information. And so it's difficult now to develop one kind of bandwagon that everybody follows.
One of the things you pointed out in your book about when the exchanges were going on prior to Christmas Eve, one of the exchanges were newspapers.
The newspapers could be exchanged because people were so close by. The Germans had land routes back home. The British actually, on their front lines, could read newspapers that were sent in that had only been printed a day or two before.
Your ultimate conclusion at the end I thought was quite beautiful. You said you conclude that the Christmas truce is a celebration of the human spirit and a moving manifestation of the absurdities of war.
But it's only true when you have cultural relationships with your enemy.
It would be interesting to see what cross-cultural relationships could generate as well, because there are things that all humanity shares. It may not be Christmas. It may be something else.
In the past, we could go back to ancient Greece and, let's say, the war is described in the Iliad, and find there were temporary truces to bury the dead or for some religious reason. They didn't last, and the war began again. There were truces in other wars, basically, again, for burying the dead and retrieving the wounded. But the cultural differences have become far greater.
The other thing that you had said was that the war continued not because the soldiers wanted to fight. In fact, the soldiers were in some ways trying to prevent their so-called enemy from being harmed. And so it was really the generals and the political leaders that then had to change the soldiers on the front line in order to continue a war.
Yeah. If you have a military defeat, your government's going to go down. If you have a military defeat, your general is going to lose his job. So a lot of this has to do with the intentions and the needs of the people who make the decisions.
And let's conclude with the counterfactuals that you started, which is, what if?
What if people refuse to fight? And we've had mass demonstrations in cities in the Arab countries in North Africa, which suggest what can happen when people get out in the mass and dare their governments to to do what they don't want them to do. It's possible. It's possible, but it's not easy, and it can be very costly and dangerous and harmful to the people involved.
Well, Stanley Weintraub, thank you so much. The book, again, is called Silent Night, The Story of the World War I Christmas Truce. Stay tuned. Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. America is more religious than most other advanced countries, according to our next guests. But religion has both positive and negative impacts on the United States. What are these effects? We're joined by Robert Putnam and David Campbell. Robert Putnam is a professor of public policy at Harvard University. He's visiting professor at University of Manchester and formerly the dean of the Kennedy School of Government. He's authored numerous books, including Democracies in Flux, The Evolution of Social Capital, and Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community. David Campbell is professor of political science and founding director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy at University of Notre Dame. His books include Why We Vote and A Matter of Faith, Religion in the 2004 presidential election. Together, they've authored American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. Welcome to you both.
Thanks very much.
Great. Yes, thank you.
Can you give us a sense of how religious Americans really are and how that really does compare with others?
It's an interesting fact that actually many Americans don't quite realize. We are, and always have been, a remarkably religious people. America is certainly much more religiously observant than any other advanced industrial country. We're well above, Britain or France or Germany, or to say nothing of Sweden or Japan, which are quite low. The most startling thing we discovered was that Americans are more religious than Iranians. The average American goes to religious service more often than the average Iranian does. And I don't mean that we're a theocracy, obviously we're not, but we're very religious, and we're also increasingly polarized in religious terms. We've always had political fights about religion in America between Catholics and Protestants. And going back to the colonial days, there were some pretty sharp disputes among the colonists about religion. So it's not that having different religions is novel, but what's happened over the last 50 years is that we've become increasingly polarized into two groups. Some people have become more religious, and some people have become much less religious. And so there are fewer of us who are kind of in the middle, who are people who are sort of religious but not angry about it. So in that sense, religion has become a more politically divisive factor in American politics than it was 30 or 40 years ago.
How about between the types of religions? How do those break up in terms of numbers? David Campbell, you want to come back in?
When you look at the array of religions in America, the first thing to note is just how incredibly diverse our religious landscape is. There is no single religious tradition that dominates, although the single largest is actually the evangelical Protestants. But again, remember, that actually comprises a number of different denominations. Second to the evangelical Protestants are the Catholics. But then right after the Catholics is kind of an interesting group that we call the nuns, that is people who, when asked what's your religion, say, well, none. And this is a group that's been growing over the last 20 years. They used to be roughly 5% or so, but now they're around 17 or 18%, and that growth has happened mostly over the last 20 years. And in fact, there are more people today in the United States who say they have no religion than we have mainline Protestants. They've been sort of losing market share.
The mainline Protestants used to be the dominant category in America. That's Methodists and Episcopalians and Presbyterians and Lutherans and so on.
And how do we break this down demographically? And one of the reasons why I ask is, in your book, you talk about how young people are really changing in terms of religious beliefs and also in terms of their politics.
Maybe it's a little helpful to put that a little bit in a sort of historical perspective, because in the 1950s, that was probably the most religiously observant decade in American history. Lots of people in America were religious, but moderately religious. And then came the 60s, and that was an earthquake, which sent a lot of people off in a sort of a more secular direction. They still would say, well, I'm a Methodist or a Catholic or whatever, but they were much less likely to go to church. And so church attendance fell very rapidly during the 60s. In the 70s and 80s, there was a counter-reaction to that, which was the rise of the religious right, as it's called, that is, the evangelicals. Evangelicals had their first aftershock to the 60s. They were upset about the 60s, and they looked around for the kind of church that would be the most fervent advocate of a more traditional morality and family values and so on, and that was the period of the rise of the religious right. That period was over 20 years ago, about 1990. And everybody knows about the rise of religious right because there's all the talk about, you know, Jerry Falwell and all the, and the anti-abortion movement and the anti-gay rights movement and so on. It's gotten a lot of ink. But the fact that it got a lot of ink then had the effect of triggering a second aftershock that's much less discussed, and that is beginning in about 1990, the fraction of Americans who were nuns, that is, people who were, have no religious affiliation, which had been dead steady flat at about 5% forever, that figure began to rise sharply, especially among young people. So among young people today, nearly 30% of them say that they are not religious. That's a huge transformation. That's the second aftershock. And that was an aftershock in direct reaction to the rise of the religious right. The young nuns, N-O-N-E-S, are not, for the most part, atheists. Many of them say that religion is important to them. Many of them pray, and some of them even go to church. What defines them is they feel completely alienated from organized religion in America today, largely because during the years when they were growing up, it looked like to be religious meant to be Republican and conservative and homophobic. Those young people said, well, if that's what religion means, that's not me. And they basically said, I'm out of here.
That brings us to one of the main issues in your book, which deals with the consequences of the changes in religion into personal and political life. Among your findings, it sounded like you were saying religious people still tend to be Republicans. And given that most are still of the Christian faith and that the Christian faith was founded on ideals like charity, forgiveness, compassion for the less fortunate, how do we reconcile what seems like a contradiction with a lot of the Republican values and the religious right?
Can I just make one minor footnote to your question? You say religious people are now still Republican and still conservative. Actually, being a correlation between your how often you go to church and your politics is quite unusual in American politics. And that's a very new phenomenon. As recently as the 1960s and 1970s, there was essentially no correlation between how often you went to church and how you voted. In that period, there were plenty of liberal Democrats sitting in the pews on Sunday morning, and there were plenty of unchurched conservatives. This close correlation between how you vote and how often you go to church really only is a phenomenon of the last 20 or 30 years. It's not true historically in America. Historically, religion was often on the side of the left politically, not on the side of the right. Remember the Civil Rights Movement, which was a left-wing movement, you might say, and yet it was rooted in American churches, white and black. So nowadays, people who go to church are very likely to be Republican, and that's as a result of the shock and aftershocks I talked about.
When it comes to the attitudes that Americans hold on a variety of issues, it turns out that religious and secular Americans only differ on few of those issues. You might think, judging from what you read in the papers and our discussion of the culture wars, that highly religious Americans and highly secular Americans disagree about everything. They don't. And on many issues, they don't disagree at all. Two that we highlight in American Grace are immigration and the death penalty. And then there are a bunch of other issues in which you'll find sort of small differences. But the two issues in which they differ dramatically are abortion and gay marriage, or rights more generally. What is sometimes called the God gap, that's the tendency of those who are more religious to vote Republican. Well, that has only come about because of the positions that our political parties or that our politicians take by emphasizing issues like abortion and same-sex marriage and then having the parties take sharply divergent positions on those issues, it leads religious and secular voters to react. And when they react, the religious folks vote one way and the secular folks vote another way. But what that all means is that if we didn't have that moral or cultural dimension to our politics, we wouldn't expect to see a God gap.
Even on social welfare legislation, that is, should we cut taxes or cut support for Social Security or Medicare or whatever, that big issue, there's very little difference between religious Americans and secular Americans. Within each group, there's a lot of disagreements, but all our politics was about was cutting spending or cutting taxes. We would not have the same kind of God gap that we do now. There's another feature of religious life in America. Okay, so that's how people behave in politics, but how do they behave as neighbors? Is the neighborliness of religious people different from the neighborliness of secular people?
Now, in terms of the neighborliness, you said that they were more trusting. One is that they are not very tolerant of political dissent. And so there are a couple of things that I thought were slightly contradictory to that. One is John Hibbing at the University of Nebraska had found that conservatives tended to be more fearful in general. Clearly, he wasn't looking at just religious people. But I'm trying to figure out how to fit all this together, dealing with the issue of trust, dealing with the issue of fear, and the issue of dissent. How do I fit all this together?
That's not actually what we meant by neighborliness. We also looked at a different set of questions, which is how often do people volunteer? And how often do they give to charity? How often do they help other people across the street or give blood, that sort of thing? And on that score, religious people are systematically better neighbors than secular people. It's certainly true that religious people are a little less tolerant of dissent. It's a significant difference, but you've got to not overstate it. Let me give a specific example from our study. We ask everybody in our sample this question: would you say that people have a perfect right to give a speech defending Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden? This was in 2006, 2007, so it was even closer to 9/11 than we are now. You might be surprised that overall, a pretty large percentage of Americans said yes to that question. America is a surprisingly civil libertarian country. I think it was about 65% of Americans said you have a perfect right to give a speech defending Al-Qaeda. Among secular Americans, 70% said yes, and 60% of religious Americans said yes. So there is a gap in tolerance, but it's not enormous, and actually religious folks were as ready to defend free speech as they are in that question. There are other questions in which you get basically similar kinds of answers. Religious people are systematically a little less concerned about civil liberties.
David Campbell, let's bring you back in. First of all, if you have something to add to the issue of trust.
Just as religious people are more engaged in their communities and more likely to be giving to charities, it's also true that religious people are more trusting. For secular Americans, that's something that they need to sort of come to grips with. If you look at both political ideology and religiosity together and see, well, who's really doing the charity work, it turns out that it's actually religious liberals, not religious conservatives, that are more likely to give.
Religious liberals are more likely to give than secular liberals, and religious liberals are also more likely to give than conservative religious people. It's the religion itself tends to make people more generous, more civically involved. Even on things like defending immigrant rights, religious people are more likely than secular people to say that they've marched or engaged in other sorts of activities on behalf of immigrant groups, for example. So this is not about right-left. It's about whether people are involved in a religious community or not.
I just want to make sure we get to the final point of your book, which is the American Grace point, which you say is this fluidity and that people are not so segregated down these religious lines. This is what you call America's grace and what has kept it from really religious divisiveness that can be dangerous.
I'm glad that you mentioned this, because I would hate for anyone listening to the interview to sort of stop here and think, oh, well, these two guys came on today and said that America is hopelessly divided along religious lines, because that turns out not to be the case. It is true that we see religious divisions in our politics, but we don't see that in the way Americans actually think about their neighbors who are of other religions. The America's grace that we speak of in the book is the fact that somehow America has managed to combine this high level of religious devotion with religious diversity and also religious tolerance. We are a people who are very accepting of those of other religions, and our explanation for how it is that America has managed to pull off those three things simultaneously, including the religious tolerance, is the fact that we have knit together a society where people make friends, have neighbors, have family members and their own spouses who are of other religions. And that all together boils down to an acceptance of those of other faiths. We call it the Aunt Susan effect. Everybody has an Aunt Susan in their family. This is someone who is the kindest, sweetest person you know, the person who's destined to go to heaven. But she's also of another religion. And you know that your religion actually teaches you that, well, people who are not on your team are not supposed to go to heaven. But you also know that, well, Aunt Susan is destined for heaven, and she's not on your team. And when faced with a choice between their theology and Aunt Susan, almost all Americans end up going with Aunt Susan.
Well, let's just hope that that continues. Thank you to both of you, David Campbell and Robert Putnam, who have co-authored American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
When we come back, it's not all bad news. We'll look at some of the widespread improvements in the world. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. It's not all bad news, says our next guest. There are widespread improvements in the world. Among the improvements, life expectancy, literacy, and gender equality have all grown in many parts of the world. What's behind the changes? Charles Kenny is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and a fellow at the New America Foundation, contributing editor to Foreign Policy. And his new book is called Getting Better, Why Global Development is Succeeding and How We Can Improve the World Even More. Welcome, Charles Kenny.
Thanks for having me.
So this book is a bit of a contradiction to all of the people who see the world does look like it's going to hell in a handbasket. You actually say there are some improvements. Start with the whole concept of development.
Well, traditionally, development has usually been defined using one number, which is income per capita, the amount of dollars the other average person gets in a year in a country. And that's important. Having more money is a good thing. But there are lots of other things that are also a good thing. It's good to be alive to spend that money. So being healthy and having a long life expectancy is an important element of development. Being educated, being able to read is an important element of development. Having civil rights, not being beaten up by the police, being able to vote for your leaders. These are all, you know, important and good things in their own right. And when you look at some of these other measures, there's been just immense amounts of progress everywhere in the world.
You spend a whole section of your book talking about why we need income first, but then why it shouldn't be the sole way that we measure how the world is doing. Poor people do suffer more generally with their health, with their security, with all of these things.
Let's take an example of a girl called Grace who lived in Uganda, and her parents were interviewed as part of a World Bank survey. And Grace, when she was about 5 years old, got a case of malaria. First of all, the parents tried using traditional herbal remedy, and that didn't work. And so then they borrowed some money and bought some chloroquine, and actually that helped a little bit, but they ran out of chloroquine. And so then they sold some chickens and took her to the hospital, by which time she was really very sick. And the hospital said, she's anemic, she really needs a blood transfusion, that'll be $5. And the parents went back to their home and tried to find $5, but they couldn't find it, and Grace died. Now, she wouldn't have died if her parents had had more money. Having enough income to be able to afford basic health services is a really important part of the quality of life. And having more money means you're more secure in a number of different ways. So money really does matter, and I don't want to say it doesn't. However, Grace wouldn't have got malaria if she'd had access to a bed net. If she'd slept under a bed net, the chances that she would get bitten by a mosquito and get malaria would have been much reduced. And nowadays, insecticide-treated bed nets are quite often freely available in many parts of the developing world, and they're saving thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. And so a very cheap intervention is saving lives even amongst the very poorest people. And that's just true of a range of other interventions. So vaccinations, the number of kids in Africa who died from measles has gone down from about 500,000 to a little over 100,000 in just a few years at the start of this last decade because of an extended program of vaccination. So we can make massive progress at very little amounts of money in improving health outcomes, even in the poorest countries.
You said that even with income, if we used it, we can see that there have been global improvements, mostly because of India and China. So give us a little bit of detail here.
Absolutely. So while there are still 800 million people who live on a dollar a day or less, and that's just not enough money. That number in 1990 was over 1.5 billion. So we've seen immense progress, as you say, largely in China and India, but also in a lot of African countries, in rates of improvement, in dropping rates of absolute poor people. And that is great news. We need more of it.
At the same time, you point out that the divergence in income between the rich and the poor has actually vastly increased. It's
yes.
multiplied, and that's not such a great thing.
In 1950, the richest country was about 33 times richer than the poorest country. It's a big difference. So say the poorest country was on $300, the richest country is nearer $10,000 a year. Big difference. That gap is no longer 33-fold, it's closer to 137-fold. And that's for two reasons. Rich countries keep on getting richer, and some poor countries are as poor as they were in 1960, as poor as they were in 1900, pretty much as poor as they were since zero. They've seen almost no long-term income growth at all.
So what we're seeing is that while there is some improvement globally, it's still this phenomenon, which you actually talk about later on, the Malthusian trap, which you say still to some degree looks evident, which is poor countries tend to stay poor. Poor families tend to stay poor, rich countries tend to stay rich, and rich families tend to stay rich.
Absolutely. I mean, again, there's a lot of good news, right? So many countries that looked like they were going to be poor forever have suddenly started to get a lot richer, India being a good example. The other bit of good news is even these countries that are as poor as they've ever been, and these families who are as poor as they've ever been, are seeing improved outcomes in things like health and education and rights. So even in the midst of this big problem of global poverty, we are seeing considerable progress.
Let's talk about some of that progress. You, of course, mentioned the health issue and how small investments have made a very big difference. Life expectancy, you say, has really improved massively, specifically with infants.
Yes, absolutely. Infant mortality is about a quarter of a level it was a century ago around the world. And it's again, it's improved everywhere. It's improved in Africa, it's improved in Asia, it's improved in Latin America. So it's not just a phenomenon of rich countries. And actually, it's improved in a whole load of countries that have seen their incomes fall. If you look at all the countries that we know of that are poorer today than they were in 1960, on average, they're about a quarter poorer than they were in 1960. Everybody only has three quarters of the income they had back then. But in those countries, life expectancy has gone up 10 years. So even countries not just stagnating, but actually getting poorer, have seen significant progress in health outcomes. They've also seen literacy rates on average double over that time. So, again, it's not just health, it's also education. And in 7 out of 9 of those countries for which we have evidence on civil rights and political rights, in 7 and 9 of those countries we've seen improvements.
You also noted that there are some advancements, especially with issues like gender equality.
Absolutely. Never before in world history have so many women been in parliaments. Never before have so many girls been in school. One of the greatest bits of progress over the last 60 years has been going from the sort of the normal global behavior being, maybe we'll send our boys to school, but there's no point with the girls, to sending boys and girls to school, not completely equally, but the girls are rapidly catching up. And so, you know, even in the Middle East, for example, there are a whole bunch of countries where there are more women in university and college than there are men. So it's not just, you know, we've reached equality. Women are overtaking men. That's just a sign of a huge change in opinions about the role of girls, the role of women in society, which I think is really positive.
And in terms of the issue of civil rights, human rights, political rights, you use particular measures to assess and say, look, things are overall getting better. I wonder, though, even while you counted the ending of slavery, in fact, if you look underneath, there is still rampant slavery. How do you account for something like that when you're looking at these numbers? Because they get missed.
The problem of human trafficking is a huge and horrible one. It's a problem, if anything, on the decline, not on the rise. For all the tragedy of human trafficking today, compare it to the tragedy of what slavery did to Africa, you know, a third of the population of the continent either being enslaved or dying as part of the slave trade process. It's a huge problem that we have to deal with, but it's not on the same scale.
And then in terms of the issue of violence, you indicated that it seems, with the numbers you used again, that there's been a decrease in violence. And again, I haven't crunched the numbers, but I know the 20th century was considered the mass murder century, and it has had mass murders, including 2 genocides just in the 90s. So I'm just wondering how these numbers are assessed.
So the number of people who die in wars is at a 60-year low. Having said that, 60 years is just after the end of the Second World War. So the Holocaust, Stalin, mass murder in Russia, First World War, as you say, when you add in those numbers, you get to certainly the most violent century that we know of. So the picture there is at best. But since the end of the Second World War, thankfully, we've been on a reasonably steady course towards fewer people dying in war every year. Also, the sort of violence at the domestic level has been somewhat on the decline. The big and under-discussed part of violence that I'm not sure we have evidence is declining is within the household. I'm not saying it's worse than it used to be, but certainly we don't have a lot of evidence that it's a lot better than it used to be. And there is something that really is not getting enough attention and the global community ought to think more about.
So when we look overall, though, you're saying we shouldn't just look at all of the difficult things. We should look at them, but we should also acknowledge that we have made a big difference as a humanity.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the reasons I think it's very important to acknowledge progress is because it suggests we can make more progress, right? If we haven't been making any progress over 60 years where, you know, the global community, for all its failings, has been trying pretty hard. I mean, there's been a lot of aid that has flown, you know, trillions of dollars of aid, and there's been, you know, the creation of the United Nations and, you know, global peacekeeping efforts, and there's been massively increased trade and investment. If all of these things have had no impact, what's the hope for the future? How do we think we're going to deal with climate change? How do we think we're going to continue making progress in child health? If all our efforts to date have been to naught, I think it's a reason to give up and go home. In fact, we have made a huge amount of progress in a huge number of areas, and that is a sign that we can do so again. It's a reason to, you know, get out, go out and try and do better.
And you say what's driving this is really innovation and great ideas and some technologies that are inexpensive that make a huge impact for masses of people. So talk about what some of those are.
There are two sides, I think, to the story of global improvement. We know, by the way, it can't be income for all the reasons we've just talked about. Income isn't improving everywhere. Pretty much all of these other measures are improving everywhere. So income can't be the driving force. The two things that are driving it are one on the supply side, new technologies, and the other on the demand side is the spread of ideas and the spread of new norms of behavior. So on the technology side, everybody knows the story of how the mobile phone is just spreading everywhere. And there, I can't remember, I think it's more than 3, maybe it's even 4 billion mobile subscribers worldwide. But that's just one technology. Vaccines have been spreading very widely. Wire, nail, all-weather roads, rubber tires, a huge number of technologies that used to be very rare in developing countries 50 years ago are now ubiquitous. Even the poorest households tend to have access.
Do these technologies also come with a downside? We spoke with Ian Morris, who wrote a book called Why the West Rules for Now, but he notes in there a couple of things, and one is that every solution brings with it new problems. I wonder, what's the response to that these new technologies, especially things like the rubber, are contributing to an unsustainable environment, which will then potentially cause more poverty?
I'd rather have the problems we have today than the problems we had 100 years ago, especially speaking as a parent. The chance that my kids would grow up healthy 100 years ago was a lot worse than the chances today. So for all of the fact that, yes, these new technologies and particularly new consumption creates real problems, especially around sustainability, I'd rather have those problems than the ones we had before. Now, that doesn't mean we don't need to deal with the problems we have today. And so, you know, I'm in favor of a carbon tax or a cap and trade, whatever we can get in order to try and reduce greenhouse gas outputs. We ought to be spending more research on sustainability. There's a big agenda there that we need to tackle very seriously. But one more thing I'd say about that is this is a rich world problem. The richest 600 million people on the planet earn 100 times what the poorest 600 million people on the planet earn. So you could double the incomes of the poorest people, and it would be the same as adding 1% to the income of the richest people. Every year we add 1, 2, 3% to the incomes of the richest people. So it's the rich people who are doing the consuming and living the unsustainable lifestyles. It is a problem for us in the rich countries to deal with. Sustainability should not be used as any kind of excuse to try and slow down progress amongst those 600 million people, you know, living on less than a dollar a day. They need to consume more. If they're going to have any kind of quality of life, they need to consume more. But the amount more they need to consume is tiny compared to the amount that we in the rich West are already consuming.
What are the policies we need to look at now to move forward?
there are still diseases that are killing millions that, for which we don't have a vaccine, so HIV being one and malaria being another. There's work ongoing in both areas, so that's on health. There are a range of other technologies that would both improve the quality of life and improve sustainability, like off-grid solar power. If we could get better at producing photovoltaics to make it cheaper to do solar power, that would have a wonderful effect on the quality of life in developing countries and be more environmentally sustainable. That's sort of on the supply side of technology. But there is this whole demand side of the picture. So, for example, if you take two states in India, Kerala and West Bengal, and you ask people in those states, what do you do if your kid has diarrhea? In Kerala, 95% of the people know the answer to that question is you give your kid a lot more water. In West Bengal, only a little less than half know that's the right answer. And the difference in child mortality between the, those two states is huge, two or three times higher, I think, in West Bengal. Knowledge is really important, and spreading knowledge on what technologies are out there and how you can use them is a really important part of the development picture, and one I think we don't spend enough time thinking about. I think we ought to be spending more time thinking about advertising in developing countries, and in particular, advertising social goods.
It sounds to me like what you mean is not necessarily advertising the way people think of it here, which is commercials for selling goods, but rather educational materials.
Marketing of one sort or another, social marketing of one sort or another, broader range of approaches to get knowledge into the hands of people about how to improve the quality of their life.
Your argument is we've seen improvement across all of these systems, socialism and capitalism systems. What do we actually attribute to this, and what's the evidence to support it?
Everywhere has seen governments grow. That's something else that is pretty much universal across the world. You know, in the 18th century, the largest governments in the world were sort of maybe taking 10% of national income. And today, the average around the world is 40, 50%, and it's about the same in rich and poor countries alike. So everywhere has seen hugely larger governments than we used to have. At the same time, we've seen all of these huge improvements in health and education. And I'm not saying it's just about government. I don't think it is. But, you know, the evidence that large governments have slowed progress is hard to come by, right? Because here we are with all these large governments and all of this huge improvement. So I think saying small government is the answer is at the best an unproven theory. At the same time, we know governments can be incredibly wasteful and inefficient and positively harmful. So there's no sort of simple relationship between the size of government or indeed more interventionist or less interventionist government and quality of life or income growth. I think you have to get, you know, much further down into the weeds. What is it government is doing? Is it doing it efficiently? Should it be doing it at all in particular areas? There's probably more to the argument there. There's a huge and important role for government in various places and not so much of a huge and important role in others. And if it focused in where it really mattered, as it might be on things like primary health care, that would be great. And if it got that right, that would make a huge difference.
I think that's a perfect place to leave it. We've been speaking with Charles Kenny, and the book is called Getting Better, Why Global Development Has Succeeded and How We Can Improve the World Even More. Thank you so much for being with us, Charles Kenny.
Thanks for having me.
That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. An extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Khwatemok Aileman, who produce this show each week. And to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.